This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Of life in the void, Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife, and Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. Her writing has appeared in Outside, Wired, National Geographic, and the New York Times Magazine. She's here today to talk about her latest book, the New York Times bestseller, Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. Welcome to Health Watch, Mary Roach.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So when I was in medical school, our anatomy teacher called the human being a glorified tube. And it feels like you're essentially structuring the book as a journey or a voyage down the glorified tube from one end to the other. I think that's a pretty ingenious way to put the book together.
Yeah, well, it made the task of structuring the book a little simpler. We're starting at the nose and we're ending at the tail. And I think that since some of the perhaps ickier things are happening further down, you start up in the cleaner end of things, and by the time you make your way down, I guess people are getting used to being in there. So I kind of want to gradually move them along toward the end that way. So yeah, it was a nice way to structure it.
So let's take our listeners down a mini version of this voyage from nose to rectum, and start with the interesting character Horace Fletcher, who's not only interesting because he's extreme in his ideas and super eccentric, but also amazingly influential at the time.
Yeah, Horace Fletcher was he was not an MD. He didn't have a medical background, but he became convinced that very, very, very thorough chewing, and we're talking at the extremes, 700 chews for a bite of shallot was one example he gave. He had this idea that you could eat a lot less food if you would simply chew it more thoroughly and extract more nutrition. He was an efficiency buff. Everything in his life was structured on getting the most out of what you had, whether it was typing letters without margins, as I found in his archives, on both sides of the page, or eating. He felt that you could greatly increase the amount of benefit and nutrition by extreme chewing. And what was amazing to me was the extent to which it caught on. I mean, there were some very, very famous Fletcherizers, including Franz Kafka. He had folks in the military who were thinking of put Fletcherizing forth as something all the troops should learn, and of course then the people who provide food for the troops could cut their supplies down by giving them a third as less to eat. So he got pretty far with his ideas. He was very well connected in society, and we're talking here back in the 1910s, 20s was when Fletcherizing was a huge fad.
And put forth as a way to solve the national debt crisis at the same time, which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah, he was at one point he was saying, you know, a family of five by Fletcherizing could afford to furnish their flat in a matter of months by Fletcherizing, and the money they'd save on food could be put towards, of course, it would have to be simple furnishings, he did add, but this from the man who lived in the Waldorf Astoria for a spell.
And it was great to read the little scene between Franz Kafka and his father, where I guess it was quite dreadful to have dinner or any meal with a Fletcherizer because they were chewing the whole time and not speaking, and he would hold his newspaper in front of his face so he didn't have to look at his son while he did this.
Yeah, yeah. It's forever changed my image of Kafka. You know, there's that iconic photograph of Kafka with the fabulous cheekbones and the penetrating gaze, and now in my head I've got him continually chewing for hours at a spell. I mean, if you do the math on this, I mean, mealtime would go on for so long that you could conceivably start to be peckish again before you would finish the meal you were working on. It was quite an extreme undertaking.
So Mary, as we travel further down the canal, we learn that chewing might be somewhat overrated, and you deal with another eccentric and fascinating piece of medical history when you talk about Alexis St. Martin and the hole in his side and the weird studies that his somewhat predatory doctor does on him to prove, among other things, that maybe chewing isn't as important as Horace Fletcher thought.
Yeah, exactly. Beaumont, William Beaumont was the physician who did this work, and this was starting in 1822 when Alexis St. Martin was accidentally shot in the side, and which opened up this hole in the stomach. And so way back when, yeah, his work showed that the stomach was doing a kind of chewing of its own, although it was more of a chemical chewing. And in fact, the way that he did it was quite creative and or gruesome. He had this mesh bag, and he would put different food items, say a piece of boiled beef or some sliced cabbage, and put it in this mesh bag into the stomach on a silk string, leave it in there for an hour, 2 hours, and then pull it back out and see what was going on with the food. And
he's putting it in through the hole in the side of his patient.
Yes, that's right. He's introducing it through this hole that has healed as a fistulated passage. It's healed. It didn't heal closed. It healed open, and there would be a little plug, which they have today, fistulated cows, where they do similar nutrition studies. But anyway, he'd put the food in, and the boy who was about 18, Alexis St. Martin, who'd been at that point hired as a houseboy, would go about the house doing his chores with his string hanging down from his side, and then Beaumont would come along and pull the bag out and see what was going on. As for Fletcherizing, this is relevant in that, with the exception of raw beef and a couple, I think peanuts are, they're hard to completely chymify or liquefy. The stuff would be broken down by the acids and enzymes of the stomach and the churning and contraction. So, you don't need to be chewing your food so thoroughly that the stomach can really handle a great deal of that, reducing it to a more liquid state. So Beaumont did, he did make a contribution in his sort of ghastly way.
And when you read the accounts of Beaumont with his patient, you see that he actually also sticks his tongue into the hole and tastes the stomach of his patient, which seems so bizarre and repulsive today. But it was actually very common in medical history for doctors to taste and smell body fluids.
Right. Back then, you couldn't just send it off to the lab and get a report back. Some of the diagnostics were done with the human senses. Yeah, you can taste. I mean, it was also, sugar diabetes. They called it that partly because there's a sweet taste to, and I'm not sure if it's the urine or the blood or both, but you could use the tongue to diagnose diabetes, and there are no doubt countless other fluids that could be tasted and smelled, so this, of course, to me, I have this image of him leaning over with his tongue in the hole in Alexis St. Martin's side, imagining somebody walking in the room, and what would they think? But it was, in the context of the era, it wasn't all that outlandish.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to Mary Roach today about her best-selling book, Gulp: Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. So you also have a section on taste and whether taste is cultural or determined through nature, and also asking this question, like, why, for instance, do Americans not eat organ meats when they are the most nutritious? Like a Inuit person could avoid getting scurvy without eating any vegetables, just by eating organ meats. Tell us what you learned about how we develop our preferences in terms of food and the experiments that were done on little babies with organ meats and brains and marrow and other foods that Americans tend to avoid.
Sure, yeah. Well, we don't come into the world with this set of preferences that this is good to eat and this is bad to eat. We are shaped a little bit by, in the womb, even a fetus is taking in amniotic fluid, and you can taste if the mom is eating garlic, say, or Brussels sprouts, some of that flavor will come through in the amniotic fluid and a little bit later in the breast milk. So, and studies at Monell, the Monell Chemical Senses Center, have shown that these kids who've been exposed to more flavors are a little bit more accepting of these foods when they're not new and scary when they're presented. So they're a little more accepting of them. But that's, setting that aside, the notion of what what is good to eat and what is disgusting or unthinkable is largely cultural, and it starts to show up in, you know, in young children. You can get little kids up through two to try just about anything. Paul Rozin, a disgust researcher at the University of Pennsylvania, did a study with kids 16 to 29 months, put in front of them things that most American adults would deem inedible: a sterilized grasshopper, some artificial dog dew crafted from peanut butter and Limburger cheese for smell and presented as dog dew, a plate of fish eggs, things that most adults would push aside. A fairly significant percentage of the babies were willing to put in their mouth and try. And even there was a wonderful study, Clara Davis, I believe her name was, had took orphans at a certain orphanage and put them on this diet, which consisted of a big table with bowls of foods, you know, nothing prepared, nothing cooked, just basic ingredients, vegetables, meats, some organ meats, in fact, brain marrow, and there were surprising results. The babies tended to try everything, first of all, and one of their top foods was bone marrow, something that, you know, a lot of American adults find a scary thing to eat or say that they don't like. Not all of the organ meats were on their list of top choices, but they tended to gravitate to some surprising things. But you know, as we grow up, we eat what the people around us eat. We eat what people on television eat, and it's tough to get a culture to change its eating habits. The United States tried to do that during World War II, and all the cuts of meat like steaks and chops and stewing meats were being shipped to the troops overseas. They tried very hard to get Americans to embrace organ meats. Not terribly successful, a little bit. It was quite a campaign. They brought in Margaret Mead and other anthropologists to try to figure out what could we do to get people to embrace, consume, enjoy these very nutritious meats.
So to follow the thread of the different cultural responses around disgust, as we move farther down the tube, gulp gets funnier and funnier as we get to the areas that are more and more taboo. But there's also when we're looking at like scientists who are dedicating their lives to the constituents in farts, for instance, but there's also, as we move farther down and there's more of a cultural revulsion to what's going on, say, in the colon and the rectum, you point out something that's really interesting about how maybe our revulsion culturally around these bodily functions is preventing real science from happening. And you cited the fact, for instance, that anal cancer didn't even have an association or to advocate for it until 2010.
That's right, yeah. They didn't even have a colored ribbon. And that is, there's a ribbon for appendix cancer. I mean, there's a ribbon for almost every other cancer that you can name, but anal cancer up until then. Yeah, there was no advocacy group. There were no walkathons. And that's tragic because anal cancer, my understanding is it is associated with HPV, human papillomavirus, and it is preventable by using a condom. It's something that people should be aware of, but there's so little conversation about it. I spoke with a historian of anatomy who confirmed something that somebody had mentioned, which was that in the early days of the study of anatomy, the colon and rectum would be cut from the body and thrown away because it tended to smell, and it was considered, I think they put it, because of its nastiness and scent bag propensities. So get that out of here. It's disgusting. So you know, I would imagine then that the study and the understanding of that organ would lag behind somewhat.
And then you have a section on fecal transplantation, so taking a little bit of the feces from one person and putting it into another to help recolonize good bacteria. And that research may have been retarded because of our squeamishness around that very idea.
Yeah, and not a little bit. I was there for an actual transplantation, and it was a fairly large amount of material. It's not, you know, we're not talking a couple grams. Really, you want to completely reseed the ailing person's colon with healthy bacteria. So you take a lot of the feces material. You know, it's put in a blender with some distilled water, and it's about a cup of material. And that seems just instinctively like a bad and repellent thing to do. But it is one of those rare success stories in medicine where it's a cheap and 90-something percent effective cure for, in this case, for a chronic infection with a bacteria called C. difficile, which can make people's lives miserable and kills about 30,000 people a year. It's a tremendous success story. And, yeah, it took a long time. The first one was done in the 50s, I believe, not for C. diff, for something else. But the idea of fecal transplant has been in agriculture with horses and cows. It's been done for decades. But as for doing it in a human, it's taken a while. The other thing going on, of course, though, is that there's no pharmaceutical company that stands to profit from feces. So there hasn't been an obvious person to kind of usher the practice through the required trials and to fund that. So that's also been standing in the way of it. But the person that I spoke with, who I went and observed a transplantation, and he said, yeah, the ick factor plays into it. It just seems to us to be, an unthinkable thing to do for men. But now, the taboo's begun to break down with it. There's been some major studies that have been published, including the New England Journal of Medicine, and there's been enough media coverage that people have started to accept the notion. And that's fantastic. I get emails from people saying, do you know anybody? People feel more free to say, hey, I would like to look into getting a fecal transplant. Or bacteria therapy is the more polite, I suppose, term for it.
To abandon politeness a little bit, one of my favorite sections is all of the various uses of enemas over the ages, you have a section on enemas used to poison people, enemas with holy water for exorcisms, but you also have this section on something that was even more widespread called nutrient enemas, which were done by President Garfield, but were also debated in the Vatican. Can you tell us a little bit about nutrient enemas?
Yes. Nutrient enemas. Before there was, if you're having trouble eating the normal way, forward, mouth to rectum, if you say you have a blockage or you're throwing up and you can't keep food in, you can eat backwards, so to speak, and you can absorb a certain amount, not a lot. I mean, the small intestine is where most of the absorption of nutrients happens, but the rectum and colon have, you can absorb salt, sugar, some short-chain fatty acids, so you can keep someone alive. You can help them survive by giving what's called nutrient enemas or rectal alimentation or rectal feeding. It's also called. And nowadays, of course, you would put someone on an IV, or you could even feed directly into the stomach. There's other ways to get food in if somebody can't swallow or is throwing up. But rectal feeding was practiced quite a bit. There's a fair number of papers debating how much nutrient is absorbed. President Garfield was kind of the poster boy for rectal feeding because his physician wrote an entire book about it called Rectal Feeding, and including recipes.
Was there a favorite food that he liked to eat this way?
It tended to be, there was a recipe for, it was the Assistant Surgeon General's rectal beef extract. So beef broth was a common one. And beef broth was the one that the Vatican began discussing because there were nuns who, during Lent, fasting was something that some of the nuns in some convents were doing, and they had taken to getting rectally fed with beef broth as a way of bypassing the restrictions, because eating is defined by the Vatican as food that comes in through the mouth and goes through the stomach. So there's sort of a loophole, so that if you were taking it in rectally, you weren't breaking your fast, and the Vatican got wind of this, and they actually thought about doing some experiments where they would see if somebody could survive this way. But of course, if the person couldn't, then they'd have murder on their hands, and so that was they didn't want to do that. But there was a lot of debate back and forth. This is historically, this is not now. This is not yet another thing for the Vatican to be fending off.
Mary, let's end the show on some science of flatulence, and I know that Hydrogen sulfide, you talk a lot about in this section, because hydrogen sulfide in very large amounts is scentless and lethal, but in smaller amounts is very stinky. And the question you answer in this is it also dangerous? So for our listeners out there who may have a flatulent partner, are they harming themselves? Are they harming themselves with the hydrogen sulfide?
I worried about this a little bit because Brussels sprouts are one of the cruciferous vegetables, like, including Brussels sprouts, are main culprits in the production of hydrogen sulfide in the intestine. And my husband is a huge fan of Brussels sprouts. And in the winter, when it's Brussels sprout season, I sometimes pull the covers over my head. And when I first heard about hydrogen sulfide and how in like 1,000 parts per million it's lethal, and I thought, could this be bad for my health? But I was reassured by Michael Levitt, who's done many, many papers on hydrogen sulfide in human flatus, that in fact it was not something to worry about, because we're talking here about 3 or 4 parts per million rather than 1,000 parts per million, and I'll survive fine. It's not necessarily a pleasant thing to wake up to, but not dangerous.
Well, when I was pre-med, before I was in medical school, I was measuring methane gas from temperate and tropical lakes in their natural environment, and we learned that some of the sources of methane in the world were termite gas, cow burping, but also a third of humans produced methane. So those third are also essentially contributing to global warming, aren't they?
Yes, they are. They absolutely are. And the other thing in association with that is that you always hear, if you are one of those one-third of the population with the bacteria that produce methane, that your flatus would burn blue, like a pilot light. But I have not been able to find photographic, cinematographic evidence of this on YouTube, so I don't have confirmation of that. I mean, I've heard it for years. I just don't know if the concentrations aren't enough, or maybe just I haven't stumbled onto the right YouTube video. But anyway, there is that urban myth that goes around.
And to loop around to the beginning of the tube again, there is some connection between human flatulence and whether you hold it in and the components in your breath.
Yes, which is not to say that one's breath would smell like farts, but because the gas in question here is mostly hydrogen, and some of the hydrogen in your gut, in your colon, is going to be absorbed into the blood, so it'll make its way to your lungs and you will exhale it. That's actually how flatulence researchers measure how flatulent someone is. But if you tend to be someone who holds in your gas, you would think that you would then absorb more and you'd have an inflated breath hydrogen rating. So it's very tricky how flatulence is measured person by person. There's a lot of kind of ways for it to be for the data to be misleading. And anyway,
did you ever get to wear the special pantaloons that the flatulent scientists use to collect and measure the gas?
The Mylar flatus trapping pantaloons, I believe you speak of. Sadly,
exactly.
We couldn't find them. They were somewhere down in the storeroom, but I had to make do with a photograph of someone wearing them. I did not get to try them on.
Have you ever looked up, I was curious about this, and I'm really sorry that I didn't bring it in, but have you ever looked up flatulence in the Merck manual before?
Yes, I once interviewed Robert Burko, who was the editor of there was a period of time where the entry for flatulence included this wonderful breakdown of the different types, the 4 different varieties.
Yes.
Flatulence, and the next editor went and pulled that out, and then somebody put it back in.
We were so shocked in medical school that this book that is so dry and clinical had this one page out of 1,000 pages that was extremely hilarious.
It was. There was like the slider, silent and something or other, and what was it? Joyfully passed in private or something like that. And there were 4 varieties. And I love that the different editors, depending on their sensibility, had yanked it out or put it back in.
Well, Mary, it was a real pleasure to read Gulp and have you on Health Watch today.
Oh, well, pleasure is mine. Thank you so much.
We're talking today with the author and science writer, Mary Roach, about her book, Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. If you missed part of today's program, you'll be able to go to kboo.fm/healthwatch, or you can go to iTunes and search for Health Watch, one word, and get it as a podcast. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine. Next up is Madness Radio with a talk about the politics of language and labels.
KBOO Board Elections 2013. KBOO members, do you have talents in fundraising, development, or new media? Are you excited about the possibilities for KBOO's future?
Are you an active member? Then here's your chance to bring your know-how to the KBOO Foundation Board of Directors.
Applications are now being accepted until June 28th, with candidate training on June 30th. To apply, go to kboo.fm/board elections or email kbooelections@gmail.com.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Sarah Davidow. Sarah is a psychiatric survivor. She's director of the Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Community, and she's co-producer of the new documentary film, Beyond the Medical Model. Sarah is a blogger on madinamerica.com, and we're going to be speaking today about psychiatric diagnosis and the politics of language. So welcome to Madness Radio, Sarah Davidow.
Hi, Will. Thanks for having me.
And I want to really encourage people to find out more about the Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Community. It's one of the most innovative mental health programs in the United States. And can you just give us a little bit of a capsule summary of what goes on at the Western Mass Recovery Learning Community?
We are a community of people largely who identify as having experience with psychiatric diagnoses, extreme states, and or trauma, who are really trying to support one another to find our own paths and healing and moving forward. And I guess the other piece of that is that we also are trying to change the world, as we like to say. And so what that looks like on a day-to-day basis is that we do have four centers in Holyoke, Springfield, Pittsfield, and Greenfield, Massachusetts, where people can go and connect with one another, attend meetings and groups like Hearing Voices or Alternatives to Suicide groups. And also then beyond that, we have a peer respite, one of only 14 in the country, called AFIA, based in Northampton, Massachusetts. And then beyond that, we also have a number of events and meetings and opportunities for the broader community to come together and learn about different ways of regarding human experience and understanding why people find themselves in extreme states and how we might want to change the way we interact with one another and find healing.
And a peer respite, that's an alternative to hospitalization that's actually run by people who have themselves been diagnosed. And how is that going?
The peer respite is going great. We are full more often than we are not. We have 3 bedrooms available to people who are coming in from community. They don't need to be people who have been labeled in any particular way by the system, but they need to be people who identify themselves as really experiencing distress, trying to avoid hospitalization or other interventions, and really just trying to find a place that'll be healing where they can connect with other people in a way that's different than the clinical system usually offers.
Congratulations on all the really awesome work that you're doing. And how did you get started in all this? I mean, where does your own story of extreme states and madness and hospitalizations begin?
I'm someone who, as a child, experienced trauma. How I would define trauma is something happening or multiple things happening in your world that really create a sense of that world being unsafe. For me, what that looked like was a parent who was coming and going a number of times in my very young childhood, and also then emotional and some physical and sexual abuse as a child. And that really shaped how I interacted with the world. And I remember as a child feeling more and more distant from what was happening around me, sort of like I was in a little bubble. That just got worse as I became a teenager, and all the other things that happen when you are becoming a teenager and trying to form your identity and figure out how you fit in the world started really making things harder, just harder for me to move through my days. And so when I was a mid-teenager, I think 16 is when I first ended up in a clinician's office. And after all this trauma, I had someone saying to me, "So you have a disease. You have something wrong with your brain. You have a chemical imbalance, just like diabetes," that line that so many of us have heard either for ourselves or on TV. "And this is something you need medication for, and will be with you for the rest of your life." And the funny thing is, in the moment, it almost felt vaguely positive, like I had some sort of answer, and I believed them. But as time wore on and I got more diagnoses, and then I'm in my early 20s, and I have at least 6 diagnoses by that point, I realized that they had no more of the answer than I had managed to figure out at that point in my life, but that what they were doing was making things worse.
What were some of the things that you were going through that brought you to wanting to get help and ending up getting these diagnoses?
I, at that point in my teenage years, was having trouble leaving my room. In fact, there was a point at which in my later teen years, I was living in an apartment